journalism is to question the prevailing wisdom. Question the prevailing wisdom.
Just speak the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
All rights reserved and affirmed.
Free all minds. These are weapons of mass dissent.
These are weapons of mass dissent.
Welcome to Uprising, a daily digest of independent news analysis, investigation, education, artistic expression, and activism. It's Monday, May 11th, 2009, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar.
It just makes me stop and think.
Silence is not an option.
Breaking the media silence on the Congo, arguing propositions 1A and 1B on the special election ballot, and a look at Montana's new gun laws which defy the federal government.
My eyes drop when the fellow meadows out, but I can't help myself, why should I?
This is Uprising. Good morning and welcome to Uprising. Members of Parliament in the Democratic Republic of Congo overwhelmingly passed an amnesty bill last week for rebels in the country's eastern Kivu provinces. Set to be signed into law by President Joseph Kabila, the amnesty would absolve, quote, acts of war committed since 2003, but would not be extended to those accused of committing war crimes. To that end, the detained former leader of the National Congress for the Defense of the People, Laurent Nkunda, would not be eligible for amnesty. Arrested in late January, Nkunda has been detained in Rwanda while the Congolese government is negotiating to have him extradited. Despite these developments, the International Committee of the Red Cross is still reporting serious difficulties in delivering humanitarian aid to the northern Kivu province, citing ongoing instances of murder and rape in the conflict between the Congolese government and the Democratic Liberation Forces of Rwanda. In the U.S. media, reporting on the violence in Congo, which has claimed more than 5 million lives since 1996, has been neglectful at best. According to research just published in the latest issue of Extra, the magazine of the media watchdog group Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, only one segment on the Congo has aired on the CBS Evening News in the past 5 years. Well, joining us on the line this morning is Kumbale Musavuli, who is a spokesperson and student coordinator with Friends of the Congo, and Julie Holler is managing editor of Extra, the magazine of Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. Welcome to Uprising, Kumbale and Julie.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for having us.
Kumbale, let me start with you. The death rate is extremely high. I understand we're talking about thousands of people being killed per month, this is something that is worse than many other conflicts happening around the world. Can you explain a little bit or give us some more statistics about how serious the war is in Congo right now?
As you stated, 1,500 people die every day in the Congo, and the Congo has been dubbed as the worst conflict since World War II, where nearly 6 million people have died, half of them children 5 years old and younger. And mainly, all these deaths and atrocities taking place in the Congo is due to the scramble for Congo's mineral resources and the resources that we use in our everyday life, gold, diamond, oil, and coltan, one of the key minerals, but not the only mineral living in the Congo. But coltan has been essential to modern technologies used in virtually every electronic device. As you see the boom in modern technology, and you see the death taking place in the Congo, we see many millions of people dying, yet the world is silent, yet most of the media, the mainstream media, does not cover what's taking place. So the challenge now is to get it to the world, to the people, because I honestly believe if people knew that 3 million children under the age of 5 died because of the resources they use every day, there would be outrage. If people knew that 6 million people somewhere in the world, in the center of the continent, were dying because of the resources that we use every day, there will be outrage.
Now, are the deaths directly a result of fighting over the resources, or are they an outcome of the neglect of the international community?
Actually, it's both. There are direct conflict as well as conflict-related causes, as the international rescue community stated, with their report they published a few years ago, with saying that the 5.4 million people have died since 98, and remembering that the conflict in the Congo actually started in 96. But as we see that, and we see this cancer right in the center of the world, we know it's essential for all of us to help end it. As President Obama stated 3 years ago, if Africa has to achieve its promises, resolving the conflict in the Congo will be critical. So we know it's essential that we stop this conflict, and we know where what are the warring parties. We know what forces are against the Congo, and if we apply the right pressure, this conflict will end tomorrow. As I can mention a few things, Canada, Sweden, and Netherlands, these three countries applied the right pressure on the two negative forces on the Congo, Rwanda and Uganda. And in January, we saw the changes of how the conflict is going to an end, where the rebel facts have been demobilized. And we see now with the latest amnesty that's been passed and are trying to resolve the conflict. So we know when we put pressure on the Congo, international pressure on the Congo, we save lives. And we hope the United States and Great Britain will do the same thing, since they are they are allies to Rwanda and Uganda, by putting the right pressure to save lives. Because if Congo is definitely saved and the conflict ends, we can all of us can enjoy about the potential of the Congo, providing the electricity to the whole continent, feeding the whole population of the world until 2050. So we know this is a scar to the human conscience not to address the worst conflict since World War II.
Kumbale Musavuli is my guest. He's a spokesperson and student coordinator with Friends of the Congo. Julie Holler is also with us. She's managing editor of Extra, which is the magazine of fairness and accuracy in reporting, which just published a detailed piece of research about the way in which the mainstream media here in the United States covers the Congo. Julie, there's been, of course, a lot of attention paid to the conflict in Darfur, and it has been named a genocide. Nicholas Kristof in the New York Times has been a particularly sort of crusading journalist, if you will, on the issue with Darfur. But why the silence on Congo, and how silent really is the media?
Well, as you pointed out in the introduction, CBS Evening News played one segment on the Congo in the last 5 years. They were the worst offender, but the best of the three broadcast nightlies, ABC, played an average of less than two segments per year over those 5 years. So it's really, I mean, in television, it's much worse than in print. But even in print, we looked at the New York Times coverage of the Congo, and if you compare that to Darfur, again, to try to wrap your head around the size of the conflict in the Congo. We know that more than 5 million, at this point it's probably more than 6 million, to be honest, people have died. This is 10 times more, or up to 20 times more, the number of people who have died in Darfur. Not to minimize the conflict in Darfur, but when you're talking about scale, the Congo really dwarfs Darfur.
I want to quote Nicholas Kristof in the New York Times that you cite in your research. He says, when comparing or when justifying his coverage of Darfur, he says, "I grant that the suffering is greater in Congo, but our compass is also moved by human evil, and that is greater in Darfur. There's no greater crime than genocide, and that is Sudan's specialty." Why is this problematic, Julie?
Well, the word genocide is obviously very loaded, and it does come with this idea of this great weight of morality. When Kristof says that Darfur is so different from the Congo in that regard, he's basically just lying. This is not true. We don't the United Nations. They actually have investigated both situations to some extent. They determined, the UN decided that what was happening in Darfur was not genocide. This is disputed by some, but the UN has said that it is not a genocide. when they investigated what happened in the Congo in the mid-90s, they said that there was potentially genocide that had happened. They were unable to continue their investigation because of lack of access. But the idea that what has happened in Darfur is qualitatively much worse or more quote unquote evil than what has happened in the Congo is simply a false argument.
Kambale, let's talk about the current news. I'd mentioned about the amnesty law that is set to be signed by the president of the Congo. What bearing does that have on the current conflict, and why is there a difference between acts of war versus war crimes?
The amnesty that has been placed, I see that as a political game that's taking place. Even though that is going to bring some type of stability for the moment to be able to alleviate the suffering of the people in the East, when you look at the history of the Congo for the past 12 to 15 years, you will see many, many peace accords written, and most of them were broken. You know, right now we have Jean-Pierre Bemba, who is right now being tried over in Hague. And we remember that he also had amnesty. He had to from the government, so he could be in the transitional government. So we know all this taking place is just a political game occurring in the Congo to alleviate the suffering. But the challenge, even for the rebel that was not in amnesty, Laurent Kunda, is to understand the global history of what's taking place. We have proxy forces in Congo were sent from years to years to create chaos.
From where are they sent?
They are definitely proxy forces from Rwanda.
Uganda. Mm-hmm.
It's been documented by the United Nations. There have been 5 reports. And the latest changes that we're seeing now, we are confident, is because of the last report the United Nations published on December 2008. Where he described how the Rwanda government has been complicit in sending child soldiers on the front, sending in military uniform that came from Boston, Massachusetts, and so on and so forth. So we know where the forces against the Congo are coming. And after years, if we do not have a regional solution to what's taking place, this is going to go on. And we know already what has worked, as I mentioned earlier. And as you just mentioned about Sudan and Congo, surprisingly, Congo borders the Sudan. So we have Congolese refugees inside Sudan right now as we're speaking. And if we are not finding a solution for Sudan, for Congo, for Rwanda and Uganda, 5 years from now, I will be on your radio show speaking about the same thing. And the reason why there have been a conspiracy of silence, as I've stated, is because of the level of people who are directly connected to the Congo, to the highest level of government. Perfect example. Samuel Badman, the Secretary of Energy of George W. Bush, his company was listed as one of the 85 companies illegally receiving coltan from the Congo. And you have more company, OM Group. You have issues talk out of Germany.
There was a news article recently, Kambale, about a Belgian company, Traxys, that has decided to suspend its sourcing of materials and minerals, rather, from the Congo and over the issue of the war, and it's trying to sort of distance itself from being connected with that. Do you see that as a positive sign, and is that the direction that the international community needs to take in its role to help stop this violence?
Definitely. I mean, as you just mentioned, Traxys. Mm-hmm. Traxys was listed in 2002, and they are halting their operation on June the 1st of this year. So think about all this time of the minerals they have received. There are things that people could do, and you have to also know there are 4 forces against the Congo. We have our local elite. We have foreign corporations that we know. You have to look at the UN reports. Some of them are listed on our website, friendsofthecongo.org. We have foreign government, which are directly stated, Rwanda and Uganda, using proxy forces, and sometimes they invaded twice the Congo in 96 and 98. And you have multilateral institutions, the IMF, International Monetary Fund, and the World Bank, who unleashed their power to put pressure on the Congolese. So as those four forces against the Congo work in cahoot, the Congolese people are the ones suffering. So what the people around the world can do to help the freedom fighters inside Congo to be able to regain their sovereignty, that could put the international pressure, as I mentioned, specifically for the United States. We just have the new Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs, Johnny Carson, and there will be a hearing next week on sexual violence in Congress. People should contact the State Department to hold corporations, American corporations, accountable for what they are doing in Congo, such as companies as Freeport-McMoRan.
I want to turn back to Julie on this issue of just information. I mean, Kumbale just broke it down very clearly about what are the main forces that are fueling this war. But ordinary Americans just don't get this information when they listen to the mainstream media. And you know, Anderson Cooper, in your research, you show that Anderson Cooper of CNN did 44 shows that covered the Congo, but the majority of his shows were not about the political conflict. What were they about?
Well, many of them were about the political conflict, but they more than half of them also included a focus on the guerrillas in the Congo. Or there was also a long interview he did with Angelina Jolie that was broadcast several times, where the Congo was mentioned briefly. And this is something that happens to Africa coverage frequently, where the coverage that you do get, it's almost like it's required to have a hook that is either around endangered animals or celebrities. I think when you're looking at Congo coverage, one of the main reasons that the Congo does not get coverage right now in the United States is that it's not in the interest of the U.S. government at the moment to have a spotlight on the Congo. When you look at Darfur in 2004, I believe it was, Colin Powell and the Bush administration called that conflict a genocide. This was a deliberate effort by the administration to bring more attention to it, and that's the year that the U.S. media started paying attention. If you look since 1998, there's been no effort by administrations, U.S. administrations, Republican and Democratic alike, to draw any attention to the Congo, and you haven't seen the coverage in the U.S. media.
And is there also a sense of people having Darfur fatigue, if you will, to call it, you know, a very crude term? But
I'm inclined to think that's not the case. I'm inclined to think that you know, there actually has been some recent efforts to connect the Darfur conflict and the Darfur activism and Congo activism. I think, if anything, Darfur may be helping to bring more attention to the Congo. It's hard to say. I don't know that there really is so much Darfur exhaustion or that sort of thing.
I want to finally turn back to Kumbale Musavuli. Can you tell us about a speaking tour that is going to take place this summer, the Breaking the Silence speaking tour?
Yes, actually it's been going on since February, and we are still on the Break the Silence tour. And what we have decided to do is to go to the American communities here in the U.S., and we want to talk to the Americans and to let them know what's taking place. And we are going across college campuses around the world, and it's amazing to see what the students are doing. About a month ago, a student in Osaka, Japan, actually organized a photo exhibit for the Congo. And you know what was very interesting as a Congolese for me to see Japanese at the side of the Congolese is that the uranium that was used to bomb Hiroshima and Nagasaki came from Congo. But in today's world, they were right beside the Congolese. So we are going across college campuses, and we want people to visit our website, congoweek.org, to sign up and invite us. So we will be able to tell them what are the best ways to help, because the challenges of the Congo are both internal and external. But as regular people around the world, we want you to be able to help. As our independence hero said, Patrice Lumumba, in 1961, before he was assassinated, he stated, "We are not alone. Africa, Asia, and free and liberated people from every corner of the world we always be found at the side of the Congolese. And we believe in that. That's why we want to get to the American people. We want to get to the people of the world so they can know what's taking place in the Congo and what informative action they can take to end the conflict so we can all benefit from the potential of a peaceful Congo, as I stated.
Well, I want to thank the two of you very much for joining us today, Kumbale Musavuli and Julie Holler. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Kumbale Musavuli is a spokesperson and student coordinator with Friends of the Congo. Their website is friendsofthecongo.org. If you want to find out about the Break the Silence tour that Kumbale just talked about, you can find out more at congoweek.org. That's congoweek.org. And you can read FAIR's research on the lack of media coverage on the Congo at their website, fair.org, F-A-I-R.org. If you missed any of this, not to worry, just go to our website, kpfk.org/uprising after 10 a.m. today. All the links will be up. This is Uprising, and later in the hour, we'll take a look at a new Montana gun law. And after today's subversive historian, we'll go in depth into Propositions 1A and 1B with guests of various perspectives. That's happening as part of the special election on May 19th. When we come back, you can find out all about it. Stay tuned.
This is Gabriel San Roman, your subversive historian. Back in the day, on May 11, 1894, 3,000 workers staged a wildcat strike in Pullman, Illinois. As an economic recession gripped the nation, the notorious George M. Pullman targeted cutbacks against hourly workers employed in his Pullman Palace Car Company. The conditions for many of the non-management employees were already untenable prior to the wage cuts and layoffs. And with Pullman City once described as a relic of European serfdom, workers had few options at their disposal. Nevertheless, the Pullman strike commenced, and in June 1894, the American Railway Union voted to refuse work on any train that carried a Pullman car, and by doing so, effectively took the stoppage national. The Pullman strike would end later that summer, however, when Attorney General Richard Olney obtained an injunction at the behest of President Cleveland to deploy the U.S. Army to break the boycott. And here I was, thinking capitalism really detested state intervention. For Uprising, this is your truth professor, saying it's no mystery why they conceal our people's history.
You're listening to Uprising. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. In just 8 days, Californians will head to the polls for a special election called by the governor and state legislature. Sparked by a budget deadlock from last year, the ballot features six propositions designed to redraw budget allocations, preserve some tax increases, and pay back schools for money owed. But likely voters have expressed a disgust with this method of financial decision-making through polls that strongly suggest all but one measure looks set to fail. Prop 1F, favored by voters, will cap legislator salaries in financially tough years. Republicans are characterizing this response as a state on the verge of tax revolt. On Friday, we spoke with Jessica Levinson of the Center for Governmental Studies, who argued that the propositions are just too complex and that voters want legislators to do the job they were elected to do. Today, we'll take a look at Propositions 1A and 1B, the two main measures. Proposition 1A would temporarily extend tax increases to help with a $42 billion budget shortfall, impose new spending restrictions, and increase the size of a rainy day fund to more than 12% of the general fund. Prop 1B, which will be valid only if voters pass it and 1A, requires supplemental payments totaling $9.3 billion for K-14 institutions to make up for recent cuts in the education budget. Prop 1B was devised by lawmakers and linked to 1A as a way to gain the support of teachers' unions for both propositions. Some teachers' unions are supporting it, others aren't. Brian Bonner is the legislative advocate for the California State PTA. He advocates a yes on a 1A and 1B position. Welcome to Uprising, Brian.
Good morning.
We also have with us Peter Stahl. He is an independent expert for over 20 years on ballot propositions. He blogs at PeteRates.com. His writings have been published at the California Progress Report. He advocates a yes on 1A position, but a no on 1B position. Welcome to Uprising, Pete.
Good morning.
And also with us is Steve Hopcraft. He's a spokesperson with the California Federation of Teachers. He says yes. He says no on 1A and yes on 1B. So it sounds very complicated. All three of you take different positions on these two propositions that are linked. We're going to try to keep it straight, but I want to start first with you, Brian. You want yes on both these top two propositions that both the governor and the legislature are backing, as well as the California Teachers Association and several others. Why do you want? Why do you think that 1A and 1B should pass? Let's start with 1A.
Start with 1A?
Yeah. Why are you in favor of 1A?
We support legislation that secures financing for public education. And this is...
Can you talk directly into your phone? We're having trouble hearing you.
I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. So we support legislation that secures financing for public education. We believe that the legislature and the governor should work together to develop a budget that meets the needs of children. And Proposition 1A is a down payment on that position of ours.
So is your support for 1A based primarily on the fact that it is needed in order for 1B to pass, and 1B is the one that will pay back schools?
It's linked to it, but it's not the primary reason. We studied this for quite a while and concluded that it's a reasonable way to begin some of the budget reform that's needed, and a way to begin to provide adequate funding for children's services.
So you think that even on its own merit, 1A is worth passing?
Yes.
I want to turn to Pete Stahl. You agree with Brian Bonner on 1A, but you disagree on 1B, which is the one that will pass only if 1A passes, and it's focused primarily on education. Why do you agree on 1A but not on 1B?
Well, I look at Proposition 1A as attacking one of the root causes of our perennial budget problems, and that's the huge swings in the size of the general fund. 9 years ago, in 1999-2000, there was a 23% increase in the size of the general fund year over year, and yet last year there was an 11% decrease. These enormous swings are due to the fact that the state relies on these highly cyclical income streams like capital gains and business income. Proposition 1A will smooth out these swings and make long-term planning much easier, and it will reduce the temptation for the state to make commitments that it can't fulfill in the long term. So that's why I'm supporting Proposition 1A. Now, I should caution voters that there's a lot to dislike about Proposition 1A. It uses a mathematical formula, which I find distasteful. It also extends the sales tax and vehicle license fees, both of which are very harshly regressive. However, I think in the big picture, it's very important for us to start attacking the root causes of our annual budget pain. Now, on Proposition 1B, the reason I oppose that is very largely the same reason I'm supporting 1D and 1E, which we are not talking about today. But all three of those propositions, 1B, 1D, and 1E, address constitutional funding guarantees for specific pieces of the budget. My take is that the state is in such dire straits that it needs to have the flexibility to determine how to fund every program. Education and mental health and the first five programs all have special set-asides, and voting no on 1B, yes on 1D, and yes on 1E will reduce the size of those set-asides and give the legislature the flexibility it needs to solve the budget mess.
Let me introduce our third guest, Steve Hopcroft. You're a spokesperson with the California Federation of Teachers. Now, you say no on 1A, but yes on 1B, even though 1A is needed for 1B in order for 1B to pass. Why? Explain your position.
Well, good morning. California Federation of Teachers opposes Prop 1A because it's bad policy. It was a deal that was put together, as we all know, to solve an immediate budget problem, and with the lack of any Republican support for fair taxation to fund our public services that we all rely upon, this was the deal that was struck. There were no hearings. There was no public scrutiny, and it's poorly written, and it has horrible impacts for the future of California. In return for a few temporary and regressive tax increases, Proposition 1A, which is a constitutional amendment, imposes a destructive permanent state spending cap. So we in education, looking at education, would lose billions of dollars in a couple of years and never regain those funds. We're already 47th in the nation, and that would pretty much guarantee that we'll be lowest in per pupil funding in the entire United States. As well, we look at the entire effect on children who come to school. It would have a destructive effect on seniors and families in poverty. It would actually harm the most vulnerable students by taking away the support services they need, and it would take away health care. Just as our baby boomers start to explode the demand for health care, we're going to tie a tourniquet around state spending. Prop 1A is a horrible idea, and the only reason that some of the groups that are supporting it, as they say, such as some of the folks on, some you've mentioned, the only reason they support it is because it's a temporary fix. But it's a temporary fix that's bad policy and puts a permanent restriction on spending for health care.
Now, what about Pete's argument that it would smooth out the wild swings in California's income and try to have a long-term stability, if you will, for the California budget, Steve?
Well, Prop 1A will have a stability. It'll reduce our spending by $12 to $16 billion.
So it's a stability at too high an expense?
It's stability at the lowest level. I mean, if you want to stabilize education funding at the lowest level of any state, then 1A is a great deal for you. But, it's not really it's being sold as a rainy day fund, but it's not really a rainy day fund. I mean, it's already raining. We don't need to set aside monies for good years now when we're in some of the worst years we have.
So
that makes no sense. You cannot do that in your own household budget.
I'm guessing that your position on 1B is more of a symbolic support, because obviously 1B can't pass if 1A doesn't pass.
Well, due to the poison pill in this, again, deal that was struck in the legislature without public input, yes, that poison pill, if 1A doesn't pass, then 1B will not be in effect. But we believe it's important to vote yes on 1B to show the legislature and the governor that we want to fund our schools. Proposition 1B is a promise to pay back monies that are already owed to our schools. This is money past due already.
I want to turn back to Brian Bonner, who I'm sure has a response to this, and so does Peter. Brian, what do you make of this argument? First of all, Steve is saying that the only reason people like yourself are supporting 1A and 1B, 1A in particular, is because you want 1B to pass.
Our analysis of Proposition 1B showed that there is a dispute among people who actually understand how Proposition 98 works, given the current circumstances, there's no specific requirement in the Constitution for backfill payments to be made when they devise the change to Proposition 98.
And Prop 98 is the ballot measure that was passed several years ago that guarantees school funding.
Exactly. It was changed 2 years later as part of a change to the GAN limit that the voters adopted. And the circumstances that we find ourselves in right now weren't actually envisioned when that was drafted. And so the law's actually silent now on whether this payment owed in what the circumstances exist today. Most people agree that there is a payment due, but it's not 100% sure. And Proposition 1D would answer that question in the affirmative.
My question was whether, you know, that the fact that Steve Hopcraft says that you only support 1A because you want it to guarantee 1B, but
no,
not necessarily on its own merit.
No, we voted on 1A on its own merit to support that. It was a long...
The California State PTA?
The state PTA body that took the position on that, that we took it on its own merits, not because 1B is on the ballot as well.
Brian Bonner is legislative advocate for the California State PTA, and he's also the incoming vice president for community concerns, and he supports both 1A and 1B. Peter Stahl, an independent expert for over 20 years on ballot propositions. You can read all about what he thinks of the propositions at PeteRates.com. He says yes on 1A, no on 1B. Going back to what Steve said, I want you to respond to the fact that 1B guarantees funds that are owed to education in California, given how terribly California is performing in education compared to other states. Shouldn't this money that was owed to California and, you know, essentially children and teachers, shouldn't that be paid back by All Rights?
Well, as Brian pointed out earlier, there's actually a dispute about how the Proposition 98 funding formula should be applied. And if Proposition 1B fails, it will be the courts that decide whether this $9.3 billion was actually an underpayment and the state is obligated to repay it. But the larger issue is whether the state should be forced to continue to fund schools at the existing mandated level, the existing level mandated by Prop 98, and similarly whether the state should be forced to continue funding on the programs that Propositions 1D and 1E support. Now, I apologize for bringing up the propositions that we're not talking about today, but my objection to this entire process is that the voters are considering programs piecemeal. They consider one program at a time. There are lots of other vulnerable populations in California that desperately need state funding, and they're not on the ballot. What about Medi-Cal funding for health care for the elderly? That's not on the ballot, and so on and so forth. So,
and that's a really good point, which we discussed on Friday with our guest, Jessica Levinson, about how essentially one of the reasons that voters look like they are not going to pass any of these except for 1F is because it's confusing, and they're being asked to make decisions on pieces of the entire budget. Steve Hopcraft, your final comment on why you think people should vote no on 1A and yes on 1B in response to what you heard from Brian and Pete.
Well, I would say that health care and education and police and fire and all of the services that we depend upon are on the ballot. 1A will decimate those services. It will lower the level of state spending permanently by more than $10 billion a year. And if you care about health care for the elderly or support for low-income families or education, vote no on 1A. Vote yes on 1B to send the message that when they go back to do the budget, that they need to protect education funding. That is a commitment that we have made in this state, and we're not keeping it.
Well, keep in mind that the governor has threatened to cut other programs if these propositions fail, and it unfortunately looks like for those who support 1A through 1E that they will fail. There's going to be definitely a difficult time ahead for this state and its budget. I want to ask very briefly all three of you to comment on one thing, which is, do you think that the next ballot measure should involve getting rid of the two-thirds majority needed to pass a California budget, and also give out a website for your organization, starting with you, Brian Bonner?
Just last week, the delegates at California State PTA Convention adopted a resolution supporting a reduction of the required vote to pass a budget and to raise taxes down to 55%.
And a website for your organization, the California State PTA?
Is www.capta.org.
That's capta.org. Pete Stahl, your position on getting rid of the two-thirds majority?
I would absolutely love to see that.
And that seems to be the thing that perhaps unites all three of you and perhaps many voters in California.
Sure. Well, it's, of course, a combination of a lot of factors. The legislators have been so completely polarized that, you know, it might be that two-thirds majority might work if we had legislators that weren't so tremendously partisan. My website is PeteRates, that's PeteRates.com.
Thank you very much, Pete. Steve Hopcraft, finally, your position on the two-thirds majority needed to pass a ballot and a website.
Yes, the California Federation of Teachers definitely supports reducing that two-thirds. It provides a tiny minority of right-wing ideologues with a stranglehold over our entire state. And you can see what's happened. It's caused a calamity in our budgeting process. It's become absurd. And we do support definitely reducing that two-thirds requirement. And our website for the California Federation of Teachers is simply cft.org. And you can read about all of our election positions there.
cft.org. Brian Bonner, Pete Stahl, and Steve Hopcraft, thanks so much for joining me today.
Thanks for having us.
Brian Bonner is legislative advocate for the California State PTA, online at capta.org. Pete Stahl is an independent expert for over 20 years on ballot propositions. His website, PeteRates.com, P-E-T-E-Rates.com. And Steve Hopcraft, spokesperson with the California Federation of Teachers at cft.org. And you can find out all about their positions on their website as well. And we're going to be covering the other state ballot measures on Uprising between now and May 19th for sure. So definitely tune into this program for that information. This is Uprising, and after a short break, we'll take a look at Montana's new gun law. Stay tuned.
The U.S. Justice Department has decided not to retry Lieutenant Aaron Watada, the first commissioned officer to refuse to deploy to Iraq. But what charges is he still facing? Join host Margaret Prescott on Sojourner Truth, 7 to 8 a.m., Tuesday, May 12th. She'll speak with Ken Coggin, Lieutenant Watada's lawyer, for the latest on the case. Also, hear from Mike Wong, a refusenik during the Vietnam War, who was featured in the film Sir No Sir and is a member of Veterans for Peace, and from Eric Gjertsen, who is with Payday, the group behind the RefusingToKill.net website. And get a report on the Winter Soldier hearings Southwest that took place on May 9th, as well as the latest update on organizing by military families from Pat Alviso, coordinator of the California chapter of Military Families Speak Out. That's Sojourner Truth, Tuesday, May 12th, 7 to 8 a.m. on Pacifica Radio's KPFK, radio powered by the people.
You're listening to Uprising. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. Montana has exerted its state's sovereignty by passing a new gun law that allows the state to dodge the federal government's interstate commerce law regulating gun control. Montana contends that guns manufactured and sold in the state, and thereby crossing no state lines, are exempt from federal requirements that require registering guns, conducting background checks, and licensing dealers. The guns would be stamped "Made in Montana." The law passed by the state legislature was signed into law by Democratic Governor Brian Schweitzer. Utah and Texas are eyeing the law and could pass similar ones, setting off what could be a major legal confrontation with the federal government. The result could be a possible overturning of a 1942 Supreme Court decision called Wickard v. Filburn, a landmark case that has been invoked to impose federal law over state commerce. Joining me now is Paul Helmke. He is the president of the Brady Campaign to Prevent Gun Violence. Welcome to Uprising, Paul.
It's good to be on the show.
So first, do you see this new gun law as being extremely problematic, and is it sort of unique in the national landscape on gun control?
It is unique. I wouldn't call it a gun law, really. In effect, it's a anti-gun. I mean, it's an anti-government law as much as anything. It's like Montana wants to go back not only to the pre-deal era when we didn't talk about interstate commerce, but they want to go back to the pre-Civil War era when the states felt they could do anything they wanted to and weren't part of a union.
So is this more of an issue of states' rights then?
It's an issue of both states' rights and it's an issue of gun regulation. And it's really on the gun regulation that it's as confusing as anything. There really aren't very many federal gun laws. There is no registration law for guns nationwide. The only real gun laws nationwide are ones that say that federally licensed dealers have to do a background check if you buy from the federally licensed dealer. And obviously that's written to keep felons and people that are dangerously mentally ill from buying guns. The only other real federal laws are restrictions on machine guns. So by saying they don't need to follow federal laws, in effect, Montana's saying they want to make it easier for felons to buy guns, they want to make it easier for dangerously mentally ill people to buy guns, and they want to make it easier for people to get machine guns. That makes no sense to me.
Now, doesn't the federal government require registering guns?
Oh, no, not at all. People think there are gun laws on the books. There are so few gun laws in this country, and that's why it's easy for about anybody to get guns. You can buy as many guns as you want. There's the only restriction on the type of gun you can get is there's some restrictions on machine guns and other fully automatic weapons. And there's a list of prohibited purchasers, but again, unless you require a background check, and we only do that from federally licensed dealers, not from the so-called unlicensed sellers at gun shows, it's pretty easy for about anybody to get about any type of gun in this country.
Are you surprised that this is happening in Montana?
Montana used to have a reputation as sort of a progressive state, good government type state. Apparently recently they've taken more of this don't tell us what to do attitude. So it's probably not as surprising, but it's upsetting. I mean, even if they've got people making guns in Montana and making ammunition in Montana and only selling to people in Montana who don't carry their guns outside of Montana, which is real hard to picture that you can do all those things, it's, you know, guns are something that clearly are in interstate commerce. And after various people challenged the New Deal era laws that FDR pushed, the courts basically said that even if you've got wheat or chickens that you raise and don't leave your state, if that product, the wheat or the chickens, are in interstate commerce, what you're raising and what you're doing affects interstate commerce. You can make that same argument for guns, obviously. Guns are easily transportable. If Montana's trying to get everyone to locate their gun manufacturing facilities in Montana, obviously it's affecting interstate commerce. So it's a bad legal argument, bad constitutional argument, and just a bad policy position.
This is the 1942 Supreme Court decision that you're referring to,
right.
Wickard versus Filburn. Now, could it not be raised that the parts for the guns are made in other states as well and have this same law be invoked?
Yeah, it's basically the concept that the Supreme Court has been following for nearly 70 years now is that any product that's in interstate commerce that has parts in interstate commerce that has any effect on interstate commerce is something that is subject to federal regulation, and that clearly I think would show that this isn't going to meet the constitutional test. But again, it's just bad policy. Why do the folks in Montana want to make it easier for felons to get guns? It's beyond me.
Now, could this law have an impact on the federal ban on assault weapons?
Well, actually, there is no federal ban on assault weapons.
There is no federal ban.
No, there used to be, but that was allowed to expire in 2004. And again, this is part of, I think, the problem. A lot of people somehow have bought into this argument that the gun lobby promotes, that there are a lot of gun laws on the books. And really, there aren't.
And it's being reported in the media. I mean, if you read the media coverage on this, the gun registration and the assault on assault weapon ban are still law, according to many.
It's there really aren't many laws on the books, again, besides some restrictions on machine guns, besides a list of prohibited the restrictions on machine guns go back to 1934, the Prohibition era. The restrictions on who gets to buy guns go back to 1968. And the Brady Bill that says federally licensed dealers need to do a background check, those are the only real three federal gun laws that we've got on the books. Other than that, it's very easy in this country for dangerous people to get guns. And I think the federal government ought to be doing more, and I think the states ought to be doing more, and I think Montana's going the opposite direction.
My guest is Paul Helmke. He is the president of the Brady Campaign to Prevent Guns gun violence. We're talking about a new Montana law just signed by the governor that allows Montana to essentially dodge some laws, particularly the federal government's interstate commerce law and the very few laws on the books that govern that regulate guns. Now, what about Texas and Utah? In particular, let's talk about Texas. I understand there was a bill that was just filed in the Texas House of Representatives that is essentially similar to what Montanans passed, that Texas-made guns would be exempt from federal regulation.
It's the gun lobby, the National Rifle Association, and others basically are pushing campaigns nationwide in various states to get rid of the few gun laws that are on the books nationwide, as well as to loosen any gun laws that they might have in those states. Basically, the attitude is that the more guns we've got, the safer we're all going to be, even though statistics always show that the more guns in a home or in a city or in a state or in a country, the more gun violence you're going to have. But there's this push to have more guns in more places by more people, and they introduce these types of bills, and they tell their legislators, this is one of the things that we're going to judge you on, and legislators are afraid to cross the NRA or the gun lobby, and they vote for them without stopping to think what they're doing. It's we've got more restrictions on toy guns in this country than we do on real guns.
Well, if you put it that way, this is, Paul, just in light of the horrific campus gun massacres we've seen and just other workplace incidents where people with access to guns and who may be either psychologically unstable or just depressed or whatever, just, let loose with their guns. Given the context of all of that and the horror that is always felt by the public in the immediate aftermath of such incidents, how is it and why is it that this push is so renewed? And does it have to do with what many in the right-wing part of the United States perceive the Obama administration as being, the sort of radical leftist tyranny that's going to push them all out or oppress them?
It's the other side is trying to construct this sort of image that Obama's apparently the cutting edge of going to take all your guns away and do all sorts of other horrible things in other areas. That's not happening, particularly on guns. The Supreme Court ruled a year ago that there is an individual right to keep and bear arms. They said that means you can have a gun in your home for self-defense. It means that no one's going to come and take everybody's guns away. The court at the same time did say that reasonable restrictions are allowed, that you can limit who gets the gun and what kind of guns they are and where they take the guns. And those are the sort of common sense things that the Brady campaign talks about and that President Obama's talked about. It's why our focus is basically let's do background checks on all sales. Let's say that some guns shouldn't be readily available to the general public, like not only machine guns, but 50 caliber sniper rifles and things like that. Let's say maybe you shouldn't be able to buy 80 of the same make and model at a time, because that's usually a sign you're going to sell out of your trunk illegally. Those are the sorts of things we're talking about. But it ties into this image of the government's bad, the government's evil, and anarchy, and therefore we have to arm ourselves and be independent of everyone else and take care of ourselves alone. It really is a denial of the whole concept of people coming together in civilization and government, if you ask me.
I want to quote from a blog, a conservative blog, that brings up an interesting scenario. Just to give a sense of some of this commentary, this particular blogger says, gun-loving people in the state of Montana are going to take advantage of this law. They're going to buy silencers, ammunition, and guns, and a percentage of these are going to be willing to put Judge Napolitano's words into action, and a federal raid on gun-loving moderate anti-government individuals may very well result in violence. Unfortunately, this is the inevitable result of an aggressively growing central government that has run out of external enemies to prosecute. Those enemies of the state begin to be revealed from within. Average people who merely want to keep the means to defend themselves or even exercise their rights of bearing arms may risk a violent interaction with federal agents in Montana. This person is, and this is referring to Judge Andrew Napolitano, who addressed a rally In St. Louis that this blogger is referring to in favor of the Second Amendment. So, Paul, this particular blogger is referring to some sort of impending violent confrontation between federal gun regulators and these gun owners. Is this even realistic?
It's not realistic at all. I mean, first of all, again, nobody's trying to take guns away from people. You know, you're allowed to, as I said, allowed to get most any kind of gun pretty easily in this country. It's a concept of government, that government is evil, that government is out to get us all, that somehow it's a foreign power. And I've always pointed out to people, the government, you know, not the problem. Government might not be the solution either. Government's us. It's what we make of it. And this whole insurrectionist, anti-government, fear of government idea is feeding into the paranoia. And it's something that we saw a little bit in the late 80s, early 90s, and that led to things like Ruby Ridge and Waco and the Oklahoma City bombings. And I hope we're not going back to that stage, but with the paranoia that some of these people are feeding, it just makes our whole society more dangerous and less civilized.
Paul, is there a website you'd like to give out?
Yeah, www.bradycampaign.org. Learn about the gun laws that we have and don't have in our country, and learn what individuals can do about it. We can make a difference here.
That's bradycampaign.org. Paul, thanks so much for joining us.
Good to talk to you. Thank you.
Paul Helmke is the president of the Brady Campaign to Prevent Gun Violence, on the web at bradycampaign.org. For Sonali, Subversive Thought for the Day, Marion Wright Edelman once said, "Guns and violence are in every nook and cranny of America. Many children can get a gun quicker than they can get a book out of the library. That puts us all at risk." That's Marion Wright Edelman. That's Sonali, Subversive Thought for the Day. You've been listening to Uprising. To get a CD of today's program, contact the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230 or online at pacificaradioarchives.org. Gabriel San Roman is our assistant producer. Louise Grillmer, Jesse Wood, and Stephanie Rivera are our interns. G is our engineer. You can hear an audio stream of this program after 10 a.m. today at our website, kpfk.org/uprising. I'm your host and producer, Sonali Kolhatkar. Thanks so much for listening, and see you tomorrow at 8.